the part becomes the partisan. And it starts off with the question of, should Wormwood reveal himself? Should he reveal himself to the patient?
Should he say, look, here I am. I'm the demon that's afflicting you. And the Screwtape totally shuts him down and just says, look, you imbecile, we don't have this question. There's no debate here. The High Command has resolved this for the time being, and the answer is no. We don't reveal ourselves to them, which has its ups and downs. When the humans disbelieve in our existence, we lose all the pleasant, pleasing results of direct terrorism, and we make no magicians. On the other hand, when they believe in us, we cannot make materialists and skeptics. This is the sort of dilemma for the opposing sides. If they knew that they were demons, then you couldn't be an atheist. Okay, you couldn't be a skeptic. If you actually saw one, you couldn't be a disbeliever. Okay, but if you're an atheist, then you can't believe in like magic. Okay, so Lewis does something here which is positively prophetic, and it's become really in these circles now. It's become really fashionable to talk about it. He talks about something called the materialist magician. And I'm not really going to go into it because for our personal walk with the Lord and our sort of ascetic walk, it really doesn't apply. But he talks about this thing called the materialist magician, where he says, if we can produce our perfect work, the materialist magician, the man, not using but veritably worshiping what he vaguely calls forces, denying the existence of spirit, in the end of the war will be in sight. Okay, there are all sorts of, if you look up materialist magician and different people, you will see different scholars saying, this guy is what Lewis said. And one of the most prominent ones is an atheist by the name of Richard Dawkins. Anybody heard of Richard Dawkins? He is one of the most prominent atheists in the world. I think he's a Brit. I think he's out of Oxford, and he is really, really prominent. He does a lot of large scale debates, large following debates, and he is a biologist who is very big in evolutionary biology. But what's really peculiar about him is he has taken the gene, you know, gene mapping, all that kind of stuff, and he has like exalted the gene to almost divine level. He's given it sort of a will of its own and a mentality of its own, and has sort of given it the idea that it has its own directing force of will, and he's basically deified it, right? So this is kind of what Lewis talked about. This guy has denied God completely and then said, and then basically taken science and said, this is magic. So it is the materialist magician. And there is a story that's told about him, and I confess that I haven't verified that it's true, but I've seen some things about it online, which you know how reliable that is. He was in one of these debates, and he forgot, he just had one of those mind blanks, okay? He had one of those mind blanks where he forgot the name of a text. And it happened to have been Darwin's sort of magnum opus, right? And he was talking about it and talking about it and talking about it, and he just couldn't remember the name of it. And he sort of put his hand in his head, and in the way that atheists will do, he said, oh, Jesus Christ, what is the name of that book? And the priest who he was arguing with went, you mean Origin of the Species? And he went, yes, that's it. And everybody chuckled. You know, Okay, so he cried out to God for the name of a book, and the priest answered him. Okay, anyway, take it for what it's worth. All right, that's all I'm going to say about that. It's really interesting that this guy in 1942 talked about the materialist magician. And now in 2014, we're seeing all sorts of these things start of appearing here and there, where these guys are talking about this, and it's really sort of out there, but people are buying into it. This guy's selling millions of books. Anyway, but he talks about the materialist magician, and then he starts talking about these other things. So let's go ahead and go to, let's go on to the first slide, because he starts talking about partisanship and divisions in the church. Screwtape says, "We want the church to be small. Not only that fewer men may know about the enemy, may know the enemy, but also that those who do may acquire the uneasy intensity and the defensive self-righteousness of a secret society or clique. The church herself is, of course, heavily defended, and we have never quite succeeded in giving her all the characteristics of a faction, but subordinate factions within her have often produced admirable results, from the parties of Paul and Apollos at Corinth, down to the high and low parties in the Church of England." Okay, now, probably remember that in Corinth, there was some divisiveness, that Paul came and really sort of established the Church of Corinth, sort of came in, cleaned up things a bit, said, no, this is how we need to do things, you over here, this is what we need, okay, set up, all right, this is how it's run. And then he left, and then things fell apart. And Peter came by, and Apollos came by, and Paul had gone touring other places. He went to Ephesus, he went back to Jerusalem, he came back, and by the time he was back in Asia Minor, people from Chloe came and visited him and brought him this letter and went, man, there are all these different groups, and he threw a fit. He said, look, this is not how it's supposed to be. But you're probably not familiar with the high and low factions of the Church of England. Okay. High churchmen are the smells and bells Anglo-Catholics. They are the vestment people, they are the Anglo-Catholics, the incense swinging, candle lighting, mass saying, hey, there's nothing really wrong with Latin, it's really pretty, the chanting, those are the high churchmen. And the low churchmen are the morning prayer, evening prayer, you should not be wearing vestments, candles on the altar are a sin. There is a great, great difference between the high churchmen and the low churchmen, and it comes from the fact that prior to the English Reformation, you had the Puritan influence of the Protestants and the Catholic influence in England, and whereas in Europe, they had these kind of wars, and each country kind of settled it in one side won out and the others left. In England, they kind of had a compromise, and neither side left. So you had these forces that kind of existed really unhappily with each other for a long time. And so they coexisted. Now, how this plays out in America now is that you have my seminary, which is the high church, high Anglican seminary, and everybody else is low church, especially Virginia. Virginia Theological Seminary is the bastion of low churchmanship. They call them the Virginia Low Churchmen, which I think would be a great name for a country band, but never mind that. And Neshota House was the high church Anglicans, to the point where even when, I mean, these are seminaries that are hundreds of years old, okay? When I was doing my internship as a chaplain at Baptist in 2001, I arrived at Baptist Hospital, and the guy that was running my program said, oh, you go to an Episcopal seminary. That's great. The other two people that are going to be, two of the three people that are in your program are also Episcopalians. And we're like, okay, cool. I'm not really an Episcopalian. Never mind that. Whatever. And so they introduce us, and the guy says, this is Steve and Mary. They're from Virginia Theological Seminary. And without even thinking and completely reflexively, I went, oh. And this guy said, this is Scott Looker. He's from Neshota House. And they both went, oh. Okay, it still exists to this day, all right? So, this, I mean, parties and factions still exist, all right? But, so, next slide. This is what Paul says about these whole parties and factions. For it has been declared to me concerning you, my brethren, by those of Chloe's household, that there are contentions among you. Now I say this, that each of you says, I am of Paul, or I am of Apollos, or I am of Cephas, or I am of Christ, because somebody's got to one-up everybody. Is Christ divided? Was Paul crucified for you? Or were you baptized in the name of Paul? At a certain point, we have to look at these factions that we're setting up and saying, was I baptized in the name of this? Did this person die for me? You know, we all have gotten to a point where we sit there and rally behind someone and get to a point where we think this guy is right up there, and something happens and we got to go with what Paul says. Were you crucified for this guy? Or, I'm sorry, reverse. Was this guy crucified for you? Were you baptized in this guy's name? Are you becoming a follower of this guy or a follower of Christ? What does the next slide say? Who then is Paul and who is Apollos? But ministers through whom you believed, as the Lord gave to each one. I planted, Apollos watered, but God gave the increase. So then neither he who plants is anything nor he who waters, but God gave the increase. Now he who plants and he who waters are one, and each one will receive his own reward according to his own labor. The planter, the waterer, it's not about them. It's about God who gives the increase. All right. So Screwtape continues. He's talking about the question of whether or not he should make the patient, and remember the patient's the term for the tempted, whether he should make him an ardent pacifist or an ardent warmonger, for lack of a better word, or he should make him really involved in the war effort or a strong conscientious objector. And he says, whatever side he adopts, next slide, your main task will be the same. Let him begin by treating his patriotism or pacifism as part of his religion. Then let him, under the influence of the partisan spirit, come to regard it as the most important part. You know, it starts off as part, and then it becomes the most important part. And then quietly nurse him on to the stage at which religion becomes merely part of the cause, and which Christianity is valued chiefly because of the excellent arguments it can produce in favor of the British war effort or of pacifism. Okay? Then it becomes, hey, you know what? This is great. I love Christianity because Christianity has the best arguments against the war. Not because Christianity is true or Christianity is right or Christianity saved my soul, but Christianity has the best arguments against the war or in favor of the war, whichever his particular choice may be. The attitude which you want to guard against is that which temporal affairs are treated primarily as material for obedience. make sure he doesn't think, look, there's a war going on here, and I need to be mindful that I subject everything going on around me to a rule of life and submit like Christ submitted in Gethsemane, and submit and make this my daily taking up my cross and following my God. No. Once you have made the world an end and faith a means, you have won your man's, and it makes very little difference what kind of worldly end he is pursuing. Provided that meetings, pamphlets, and policies, movements, causes, and crusades matter more to him than prayers and sacraments and charity, he is ours. And the more religious on those terms, the more securely ours. I could show you a pretty cage full down here. You know, we have this problem. I fear that there are a great many people who are started off as very devout Christians, secure in their faith, and because of circumstances in these days, have become Second Amendment Christians and are now becoming Second Amendment people who are using Christianity or pick your poison, okay? The real danger for us is that we in the CEC could become this way with the pro-life movement. Okay? Because they're so closely together. I know people who are so in the pro-life movement that you wonder if they do anything else. Okay? And you wonder, where's the rest? Okay? And the pro-life movement is really, really important. I mean, we're talking about saving children. I mean, what would God approve of more? But it's not the whole message. And we got to be careful that the part doesn't make us all partisans and doesn't make us people who are dividing and leaving behind Christ in favor of a movement. Okay. So, let's go on to letter 8. Letter 8 is really powerful. The law of undulation. If you don't know, undulation is a wave-like movement from the Latin undus, meaning wave. Undulation is going up and down. Okay? And in a undulation, you have a peak and a trough. Okay? Like a feeding trough. Okay? So, I love the fact, God, I just love his demonic names. Slubgob. Okay? He has these names that are almost like names out of a Dickens novel. Okay? Because they so reflect this idea of this guy being just this horrible fat beast. All right? And he happens to be the head of the demonic training college. So, of course, he's an educator. Anyway, okay, so Slubgob. And he starts off with this fantastic quote, "Humans are amphibians, half spirit, half animal. As spirits, they belong to the eternal world, but as animals, they inhabit time." You have to sort of appreciate the fact that Lewis has managed to latch onto something that is true, and in a narrative technique managed to say it in such a derogatory way. He managed to call us frogs and toads, but say something that's really true. Screwtape continues, "This means that while their spirits can be directed to an eternal object, their bodies, their passions, and imaginations are in continual change, for to be in time means to change. Their nearest approach to constancy, therefore, is undulation, the repeated return to a level from which they repeatedly fall back, a series of troughs and peaks." That's the closest thing we get to being constant. The fact that we constantly change. We have our good days and we have our bad days, and that's what's constant about us. We have our ups and we have our downs, and that's constant. Lest anybody disagree, Jesus said, "That which is born of the flesh is flesh, and that which is born of the Spirit is spirit. And the Spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak." Basically said, you have flesh and you have spirit, and both are important. Okay? Now, then he elaborates. Now, it may surprise you to learn that in his efforts to get possession of a soul, he relies on the troughs even more than on the peaks. Some of his special favorites have gone through longer and deeper troughs than anyone else. Now, yes.
That's talking about God.
Yes. In his efforts to get possession of a soul, he, notice the capital he, or the capital H in he. I don't know if it's, the fact that Lewis can't just get away from the divine pronoun, or what, but Lewis still capitalizes the H. He capitalizes all the divine pronouns. So, yeah, even when he's referring to God, he still capitalizes the H. So, yeah, God relies on the troughs even more than on the peaks. And he talks about the differences between temptations of the peaks and temptations of the troughs. And he says it's a different kind of temptation, okay? And talks about what those differences are, and that's just kind of interesting. But actually, when I thought about this, the first thing I thought about was, Father Melanson might remember this, a couple years ago, we did a Lenten retreat at a Benedictine Abbey in St. Leo, Florida. And they did these readings from a biography of Mother Teresa, where they were talking about her journal, where they're reading from her journal, and at night, the brothers didn't talk, and at dinner they just sat there and ate in silence while somebody read from this biography, and basically it said that Mother Teresa, from about the time she got off the plane in India until basically she died, she never had a feeling like she experienced God. She had these great, profound encounters with all these different, just had this profound mystical encounter with all these different experiences with God prior to getting to India, and she really felt led to go to India and had this, and then she got to India and was like, crickets. And her whole ministry in India, there was nothing. But she still stayed there. Still ministered tremendously. Okay? Then he talks about the difference between God and the devil. And this is an amazing quote here. He says, "He cannot ravish, he can only woo." The devil doesn't care what condition you are in when he gets you to hell. So he doesn't care. But God wants you to come by choice. He will court you. Devil doesn't care. His ignoble idea is to have his cake and eat it too. He continues and says, hence the prayers offered in the state of dryness, the trough, are the prayers which please God, him, the best. We can drag our patients along by continual tempting because we desire them only for the table. The demons just want to consume them. And the more their will is interfered with, the better. He cannot tempt to virtue as we do to vice. One more. He wants them to learn to walk and must therefore take away his hand. If only the will to walk is really there, he is pleased with their stumbles. I get the idea of a father teaching a child to learn to ride a bike. Dad has to let go. Do not be deceived, Wormwood. Our cause is never more in danger than when a human, no longer desiring but still intending to do the enemy's will, looks round upon a universe from which every trace of him seems to have vanished and asks why he has been forsaken and still obeys. This may sound familiar if we go to the next slide. We can see about the ninth hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice saying, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, that is, my God, why have you forsaken me? From Matthew 27:46. And that little A there, it means there's a footnote which says Psalm 22:1, which is, not in the slide. But that's okay, because Psalm 22:1 says, my God, why have you forsaken me? It is a psalm of David. At a point in his life, David, who had been cast out and exiled, cried out to God and said, my God, why have you forsaken me? Think about David. In his dry periods, in his exile periods, he wrote a psalm, a prayer, that Christ himself echoed on the cross. I think that qualifies as a pretty magnificent prayer. Okay, I think that qualifies as, one, David being a man after God's own heart and praying a magnificent prayer. All right. Letter number 9, temptation in the troughs. All right, letter number 9 begins with this little mini diatribe about the difference between tempting a patient that is in the peak with a patient that is in the trough or valley. And he talks about lust while in the peak and lust while in the valley. And he talks about the difference between, you know, lust on the peak is much more likely to get involved with love. It's much more likely to get, you know, bothered in with that. Oh, I'm in love. And lust in the valley, lust when you're in the trough, you're much more likely to get the nasty stuff. It's much more likely to become perverted. And he talks about alcohol. He says, you know, people who are in a peak, they're likely to use alcohol to make merry with their friends. But they're not really likely to really abuse it. The people who are really likely to abuse it are the people who are using it. The word he uses is an anodyne. People who are using it as an anodyne, which is a painkiller. The people who are really likely to abuse the alcohol is the people who are using it to numb themselves because they're in pain. Those are the people who are likely to get themselves in trouble. And he also says resistance is highest when you're at a peak. You know, when you've just had this mountaintop experience, there's this red light that goes off and says, I'm starting to go into an area of sinfulness. I should probably back off. I have had a great religious experience. But he also talks about what happens when these new converts have their religious experience start to wear off. All right. right? What happens when they start to feel like it's no longer there? And then he starts to talk about pleasure. Okay? All right. And he says, never forget that when we were dealing with any pleasure in its healthy and normal and satisfying forms, we are in a sense on the enemy's ground. I know we have won many a soul through pleasure. All the same, it is his invention, not ours. He made all the pleasures. All research so far has not enabled us to produce one.